Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, January 11th, 2015. This is episode 1152. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by HipChat Plus. Collaborate, save time, and be more productive with your teams. HipChat Plus is IM, video chat, plus file, code, and screen sharing all in one place. Invite your team members and get a free 30-day trial of HipChat Plus at hipchat.com/techguy. And by FreshBooks, the simple cloud accounting solution that helps millions of entrepreneurs and small business owners save time billing and get paid faster. Join over 5 million users running their business with ease. Try it free at freshbooks.com/techguy. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple product is worth at gazelle.com. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk tech. Computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, home theater, all that jazz. 888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number, 888-827-5536. That's toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. If you're outside the U.S. or Canada, you might want to use Skype. You can reach us that way. You'll be talking to Heather Hammond, the Phone Ranger. 888-ASK-LEO. CES is over. Oh, my gosh. Thank goodness. Even I, who didn't go to the International Consumer Electronics Show, was very happy when it was over, because social media, the internet, flooded with stories about CES and all the wonderful things you could find there, like self-driving cars, robots to do our daily household tasks. Yes, it's the amazing city of the future, Las Vegas, 2015. Not much else to say about it. It's like, you want a 110-inch TV? You can have it. It's there. You can buy it. You got the money for it, you can get it. Not a lot of camera announcements at CES. That's kind of stopped happening. That used to be a place where they do that. Now there are other shows like Photokina where they do that. We thought that cars might not be a big deal. I think I might even have said that last week. And yet they were. There were quite a few car displays there. A lot of autonomous vehicles. Mercedes showed a concept car, which was a living room on wheels, basically. You'd sit in your swivel chair, talk to your friends, have some wine and cheese while the car silently and effortlessly delivered you to your destination. Just in time. It really... my friend Molly Wood, who writes for the New York Times now, wrote a great piece in which she said it is kind of like the 1939 World's Fair. Someday you'll be able to see the person you're talking to on the telephone set. But we're living in the future, so that's appropriate. It's fair. We live in the future, and that's what you see at CES, is the future. Maybe not the distant future, the near future. Lots of wearables, things you wear on your wrist. Nobody, it's kind of interesting, has done anything like the Google Glass, really. There were a few half-hearted attempts which never shipped. On the other hand, a lot of people are doing visors to copy the Oculus Rift. That's a virtual reality headset that you wear. Samsung's done it, and other companies now, I think Sony, have announced these visors. Now, you wouldn't want to wear them walking around because you'd bump into stuff. It's really more for your living room, a way to play video games. It's guaranteed to make you nauseous. Pretty much guaranteed. Although I have a little tip I've learned. Somebody from the last time I tried the Oculus Rift, I really got turned green. But I was in a video game, running up and down hills. I had weapons in my actual physical weapons in my hands that were slave to the video game. So there was this odd, sensation of moving around when you're not. And of course, that's the worst thing. Your brain goes, no. And it took me about 5 minutes to just get green to the gills. Guy from the Air Force said, yeah, that happens at flight simulators. We just put a cold washcloth to the pilots' necks. He says, works every time. So a little tip for you. Next time you're wearing your virtual reality helmet in the city of the future, try a cold wash truck. Have your robot bring you a cold washcloth and put it on the back of your neck. In fact, probably robots in the future will be pre-programmed to do that as soon as they sense any form of sickness, motion sickness. They'll just come and pat the back of your neck. In fact, the real robot of the future probably has a washcloth hand. They can just come right over and tap you on the back of the neck. The future is here now. So exciting. TVs, we saw a lot. In fact, we talked yesterday to Scott Wilkinson, and I point you to his Home Theater Geeks podcast. We do this every year. It's become a ritual now. Scott goes from booth to booth to booth like a wandering minstrel looking for the latest in cool TV technology. And if you want to watch that entire, I think, more than an hour-long presentation, we have it online at Twit. TWIT.TV, twit.tv/HTG for Home Theater Geeks. And but Scott reported yesterday on the show, and he says he's very excited about the new... What was he excited about? He was excited about something. The new TVs. They're exciting. Actually, we do have a standard. This is probably important news. We do finally have a standard for Ultra HD, UHD. You may remember we've been counseling you probably not to buy any of the 4K, and they're very inexpensive now, 4K TV sets on the market, because UHD, the standard, hadn't been set. Well, now apparently it has. The standard for a UHD Blu-ray player has been set. This, of course, has to hold a lot more data, 66 to 100 gigabytes on a single disc on these UHD Blu-ray players. And, of course, the TV sets, I'm sure, will be very expensive, as will the Blu-ray players, at least initially. And they won't be available, at best, until this fall. But he was very excited over that. And I am too. You know, I've said for some time that the big revolution in television is not going to be 3D. It's going to be 4K or ultra-high definition. And I think that that's the case. So I'll start saying, an analog kid saying this, and you're right, no longer should I say 4K. 4K comes from the fact that HD is kind of 2K, and UHD, Ultra HD, is sort of twice that in each dimension, but really it's better to call it UHD. They've decided on the color gamut, that is what the color space should look like, what colors it should and should not be able to display. That's important. You have to have some agreement on that. So when the television shows or movies are produced, they're produced to that particular range of colors, and the TV can display that. You don't want to have a mismatch there. So they've settled on that. They've settled on the compression algorithms, HEVC, or H.265. That's going to be probably the standard for streaming 4K and for compression on the Blu-ray discs, as a matter of fact. Very high-quality standard. So we've kind of settled. Now, those of you, somebody in the chat room is saying, I watched Netflix in 4K on my TV. Yeah, but that's pre-standard. So Netflix is streaming something in 4K, not UHD, but something in 4K. Marco Polo, House of Cards, which is coming back. Not House of Cards. Is that right? Yeah, House of Cards is coming back next month. And that was shot entirely in 4K. So there is content, but the problem is, in order to get that through your pipe, your broadband pipe, you've got to squeeze the heck out of it. So I don't think it'll look as good as a Blu-ray, the new Blu-ray, UHD Blu-rays. Speaking of your fat broadband pipe, FCC has indicated that it will decide finally on net neutrality rules next month in February, and has telegraphed, but we'll see. You know, these could be trial balloons waiting to see if somebody shoots them down. But Tom Wheeler, the chairman of the FCC, has kind of sort of indicated he's in favor now of the Title II regulation that everybody's so worried about. Well, when I say everybody, I mean the broadband providers like Comcast and Verizon. Many internet advocates say this is the only way that the FCC can protect a free and open internet, is by calling internet service providers, broadband providers, calling them public utilities. Seems fair. Then they can be regulated like public utilities. That's a good news. That's good news, I think. I don't know if that was at the CES, but it's same time frame. So look for that. We'll find out in exactly what's going to happen in February. Do you ever use Yelp? There's been a battle over Yelp's reviews, and a recent court case said in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said that Yelp's tactics, because what Yelp has been doing is they go to restaurants and say, you know, you really should buy advertising with us, and then we might not have so many bad reviews. And the court said that's just hard bargaining. Just hard. It's legal. So there's an Italian restaurant that's now paying for bad reviews. We'll talk about that and a lot more. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number. 888-827-5536. We are in that weird time now. And we'll be for the next few weeks where people come around and go, don't tell me. I don't want to know. What's this? Don't tell me the score. Don't say it. Somebody in the chat room said, don't say the score. I'm taping or DVRing the show. It's the new thing is this no spoilers thing. And, gosh, that's annoying. I understand you don't want to know. But who is the onus on, really, for not knowing at this point? Now that you've decided that you don't want to be part of the modern, you know, of the current world.
Live.
You want to live in the future world. On whom rests the burden of making sure you don't hear the score? Me or you? The rest of the world
is... If I don't want to know it, I need to cover my ears.
Well, I think...
Yeah.
There's this whole, you know, and it happens also in the geek world. Spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. Where you can't say, and I'm not even going to say it, you know, things like who Darth Vader's son is, because that they'll go, oh, I didn't see it yet. Well, what is the statute of limitations?
Right?
Shouldn't there be? And
I was going to rent JFK. Don't tell me what happens.
Yeah. I don't want to know. No, I'm taping it. I feel like I want to be civil. I understand. I want to be civil. But at the same time, who is the onus on?
You just have to go into a steam room and hide out.
Huh? John, who's also DVRing it. Now, that's different. John, but there's a guy in the chat room who says, don't say it on the radio. And that's really true. It wouldn't just be John if I said the score of the football game. It would be probably dozens, if not hundreds, of people John has to work. He says, mm-hmm. I don't want it. Don't tell me. But I think a major national sporting event, the Academy. Nowadays, if you're going to do that, you better stay away from Twitter, right?
Oh, yeah.
Twitter will tell you everything.
Oh, for sure. There's a football game?
Twitter says people are dead when they're not even dead yet. They're like, Twitter will just tell everything. So, yeah, that's exactly right. Then there's the other people. Go. Football? What's that? Sportball? Eggball? The Soother writer, who is our official arbiter of etiquette and netiquette, says, for TV or films, in 6 months, it's fair game. For sporting events, 1 week. So there's a one-week moratorium. I disagree on the sporting events. 24 hours. You watch it tonight, right?
Yeah.
If you don't watch it by tonight, I'm sorry. I can't be held. But then, but the other problem is, by then, who cares? I don't even know who played in 24 hours. There was a game?
Mm-hmm.
What happened? Who cares?
The world's moved on.
Tonight is the Golden Globes. So if you don't want to know how drunk Amy Poehler was, you probably shouldn't visit Twitter for the next few hours. Golden Globes is fun because that's the one award show where people apparently are drinking heavily and they don't, and it's silly. I love that show.
It's so fun.
Mostly because I think the awards don't really count that much, do they?
It seems like they do. It's sort of the precursor.
It's the first show of the awards season. And the awards are just like everything else. You don't tell me. Especially if they don't do it live. See, they got to do it live. I think some are alive and some are not. I think the Grammys were not last year, right? And that was a big deal because Twitter was a fire with who won. And then on the West Coast, see, we live on the West Coast. We find out 3 hours later or instantly on Twitter. I think the Academy Awards, I think, are live for that reason. Everything should be live now.
Right, right. Because celebrities in the audience are going to be like, hey, thanks for the award. Oh, shoot.
That was an interesting announcement, by the way, at CES. I'm going to get to the calls. I'll talk more about CES. Dish had a very interesting announcement at CES for the cord cutters. But before we do that, Heather Hammond, the phone ranger, that's who I'm talking to. It's not some female voice in my head, as some of you have presumed.
Your new robot.
My little robot. Would you just put a cold cloth on my neck? Thank you. Heather Hammond is our phone ranger. She answers the phones, prepares you for your appearance on national radio.
You just undid all my doing.
Oh, don't get nervous. It's just you and me. Who should I talk to first?
Well, speaking of DVRing,
yes.
Jerry in Whittier, California has a question about that very thing.
Ah, hi, Jerry. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Oh, hi, Leo. I have a question, and I'm hoping that you can solve it for me because nobody else seems to know the answer.
All right.
I am currently receiving my television through Dish Network, mm-hmm. and when I added a hard drive to the DVR, the first thing I had to do is reformat it.
Right.
And it puts it in a format that makes it incompatible with computers.
That's right. You have to bless it. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Now, I am considering changing service providers right now. And I've got a lot of stuff on that hard drive.
Oh, yeah. You won't be able to use it with anything else.
Is there any standard between the services?
No. You won't be able to use it with anything else.
Is there any way to convert it?
No. Well, here's the deal. The reason this is not because everybody has a different standard. In fact, they probably are, for the most part, formatted with a Linux format called EXT2. Then there is blessing, which means you have to do some special stuff to the drive to say this is a TiVo or whatever. But that's not the issue. The issue is encryption, because the motion picture companies and the television companies are deadly afraid that you will take that hard drive, and on it it's loaded with great movies and TV shows, and you'll then burn them to discs and sell them on a blanket on your front lawn.
Mm-hmm.
So they, in fact, highly encrypt those, and of late, the encryption technology has been pretty effective. So some companies do offer a to-go feature. TiVo has a to-go feature where they do allow you in kind of some restrictive fashion to create a DVD that you can then use. But you taking the disc out and using it somewhere else, no.
Okay. That pretty much
puts the kibosh on that one.
Or creates the problem.
You know, once you get into this area quality content, high quality content, content people want to protect, you're out of luck. They're not going to let you do any of the things you want to do because they're so afraid of piracy. And you know, I'll go on a little soapbox here because why not? I do every time. The problem with these kinds of copy protection techniques is they're easily circumvented. They are circumventable. It's illegal technically to circumvent, but people do it all the time. The bad guys don't care. They're bad guys already, right? They don't care. And they know how. So it really doesn't stop piracy, large-scale piracy. It just doesn't. It only hinders you. It only hinders us, the honest folk, who haven't learned the secret techniques, who don't want to steal. We just want convenience. I just want to take this full hard drive of stuff and use it. Now, you could put it in a new DVR, but you'll have to do exactly the same thing you did before, which is reformat to their unique format and bless it to make sure that it's, you know, compatible. And then they'll have their own encryption with their own keys, and so you'll have to erase it, in effect. And the bad guys absolutely know how to get around this. There's all sorts of ways. You can use the analog hole, for instance, to play stuff back. It's the protected content, but the only people it protects is Hollywood from us, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by our good friends at the Atlassian Corporation. I'm a big fan of HipChat. Have you used HipChat? Our business uses it like crazy. So you can use, you know, I mean, if at first you might say, well, I can use Instant Messenger. I have lots of those. No, HipChat is designed for communication among teams. And HipChat Plus does stuff that only HipChat can do. I am a big fan. We started using it in our web design team. So our web design team's in Austin, and they said, we use Jira and we use HipChat. So get your HipChat going. And I've been using it, and now I'm loving it. So we started using it in engineering. We're going to use it in sales. If your team is communicating over email and IM and then texting and then cloud storage and document sharing, HipChat puts it all in one place. It's IM, yeah, but it's also video chat, document sharing, screen sharing, system updates, code sharing. Faster than email, more efficient. Plus, you with HipChat, you've got the record of everything you've said. So it's like email in that sense. You can go back in time, which is great. HipChat Plus keeps your team in sync, and it works from any device. That's another thing. I have it on Mac, PC, Linux, iPhone, Android, Windows, everywhere. Plus, it integrates with the top developer tools, GitHub, Jira, Zendesk. In fact, there are 57 services that HipChat plays nice with. I love it. We're always connected. Our team's always connected. It could not be easier to set up. It's fun to use. They even have a web-based one, so you can use it on a Chromebook, too. Yes, indeed. Makes your team wildly productive. Get your team on the same page in seconds. I want you to try HipChat Plus for free. You don't need to give them a credit card. Visit HipChat.com/TechGuy. By the way, secure? Yes. 256-bit SSL. Full-time. HipChat.com/TechGuy. Click the Start Chatting button. You'll see it right there. To sign up. Then invite a few team members, and you got all the features free for 30 days. After the free trial, you can always stick with the freemium version. It costs you nothing. Or if you have the need for the premium version, you can do that. HipChat.com/TechGuy. And for the first 100 signups, HipChat's going to extend that 30-day free trial to 90 days. Now we're talking. Your team will love it. I love it. We love it. We use it like crazy. HipChat.com/TechGuy. It's built for business, built for productive developers, teams, fully customizable. HipChat.com/TechGuy. If you haven't tried it, you've got to try it today. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy, 8888. Ask Leo, the number 888-827-5536. You've come up with a good one, Heather, for a robot. A robot that could figure out how to turn on the TV. That would be useful. So you're staying at a friend's, and you would like to watch the Golden Globes tonight, but you have no idea how to get that TV to work. Mm. Have you been able to turn the TV on?
I was so scared I didn't try. Maybe I'll try the one downstairs.
So I have a... Yeah, that's what the other thing is. Well, I'll use the one in the guest room, the little one. I am using my geek brain to try to think of a way that can explain this to anybody so that they can operate the audio-visual system in any home. And I think this would be a great contest where you have a randomly set up audio-visual system. And you just you say, okay, 3, 2, 1, go. I want to watch Oprah. And then and some people could just go, yeah, you do this, this. So I have the prescription, Heather. First thing is you've got to figure out which remote goes to which device. There may be many devices. You've got to identify the devices in the AV system. There'll probably and certainly be a TV. There may be speakers separate from the TV. There'll be some sort of input device, a cable box, a DVD player, a Blu-ray player. Sometimes the input device is sneaky. Sometimes it's like a Roku box or a stick stuck into the back of the TV. So that you gotta take some time and think and suss it out and kind of explore and look and see what's out there. So you gotta find all the input devices. It may be a video game system. It might be an Xbox One. Often there are multiple inputs, right? But there's almost always just one output, a screen and speakers. Those are the outputs. Now somehow we have to get the input to come out of the output. So the first thing to do is to find each remote control. Make sure they all have batteries. Make sure the batteries, and I kid you not, the other day I had to do a house call. TV won't turn on. The batteries were put in upside down. So sometimes it's little things. You gotta be precise. Mm-hmm. So you've got the batteries. You've got the remotes. You've got them lined up. You've got them assigned each to one. There's a TV remote. There it is. There's the Blu-ray remote. Now, sometimes we really want to confuse people. We call this the spousal confusion device. It's an AV receiver. That would be an intermediary between the input and the output. So there's some box that the Blu-ray... And this actually is a good setup. Almost all my TVs have this setup where the Blu-ray, the PlayStation, the Roku, the Apple TV, they're all plugged into a AV receiver, which takes many HDMI inputs. HDMI is the way we connect audio and video. And then has one HDMI cable going to the television set. Now, if that's the setup, that actually is pretty easy. You just have to figure out how to use the AV receiver. You have to figure out how the AV receiver talks to the TV set. So the first thing to do is make sure everything's turned on. TV, receiver, output devices, Blu-ray player, everything. Turn everything on. And then we've got to kind of suss out. The old school way was you turn to channel 3 on the TV. We don't do that anymore. Nowadays, there's going to be an input button on the TV remote. And you're going to select the right input. It might be HDMI 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Sometimes there's many HDMIs. There might be a TV setting. Don't be fooled by that. TV's rarely on TV. I think it's a common cause. If you see snow on the TV, and it's going, there's nothing connected to that.
Oh, good to know.
You're probably tuning to an HDMI port. So that's why you've got everything turned on, because when you go to HDMI 1, you'll see something. You might say Roku, might say Apple TV. Now, the Apple TV makes it hard because the Apple TV goes to sleep. And when it goes to sleep, it's as if it's off. So you have to tap the remote a couple of times on the Apple TV to say, wake up, little Apple TV. Oh, Apple also makes it hard because they don't say Apple anywhere on their remote. You're just supposed to know. It's a little silver remote. That's annoying. Mm. See, these companies make this hard, don't they? Once you've figured out what goes to what input, and it may be the AV receiver going to input HDMI 1, for instance, on the TV, then you can change if it's got an AV receiver, change the AV receiver using its remote to cable and DVD, and they'll have a variety of different choices. So you've got to get the output device lined up to the input, and you want to make sure all the intermediaries are talking to one another. Isn't that easy?
I think I got it, Chief.
Conceptually.
And there's always my backup plan of just go watch it at the bar down the street.
Always easier. Bob in San Jose, California, you're next. Hi, Bob. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
How you doing, Leo?
I'm well, Bob.
Yeah. Oh, the score is 147-45.
Not listening.
It was basketball score. Anyway.
Yeah, I know. What the hell game was that?
I have no idea. So let me get to my question.
Yes.
I work for a guy, and he has to get his 10-year-old daughter to turn on his television.
Well, that's often the case. The kids have no trouble.
Yeah, they have none at all.
They go, oh, yeah, well, so, Dad, don't you understand? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm trying to, I'm sort of like a very inept engineer. And what we've got is we've got a Canon Rebel T3i.
Nice camera.
Want to use it? It's a great camera.
Yeah.
So want to use it as a webcam for go to webinars, Skype, Camtasia recording, and so forth into the PC computer.
Right.
But the only software that it seems to have is this EOS something or another.
You wouldn't need software. So here's the deal. It may or may not do this. What you want is HDMI pass-through. That camera does have an HDMI output, I think, doesn't it? It's like a mini HDMI.
Yeah, so, it's a mini HDMI.
So your first thing you're going to need is a cable that says that's mini HDMI to regular HDMI. Plug that into the TV, plug it into the camera, turn on the camera. Now, you may, if you're lucky, you may have, not all cameras can do this, something called HDMI pass-through, which means whatever the camera sees, you can see on your TV. If that's working, you're done.
Yeah, but we're not hooking it up to a television. We want to hook it up into the computer.
Oh, that's right, because you're doing Skype. Does this computer have HDMI in?
No, I don't think it does.
Okay.
So
now you have to get an adapter of some kind. Now, that camera probably also has another form of video out. A lot of times they have composite video out. So you'll have to see what the output of the camera, what kinds of video it can output, and then connect that to your computer, see what kind of inputs the computer has. And then if you've matched that up, then turn on the camera and see if you can see what you can see.
So I might have to add a card inside of the computer to...
Well, I wouldn't. If I were you, it'd be cheaper to get a camcorder. But for $90, you can get a USB webcam that'll be just as good.
Oh, it will be. Okay.
Yeah. You know, your T3i, here's what your Canon can do. Because it has interchangeable lenses, you can make beautiful shots. But are you using it for what, Skype?
Yeah, for Skype and recordings of trainings and things like that.
Oh, all right. I think it's easiest to get a $90, get a Logitech C920 webcam They're about $90. They connect to the USB port, which your computer has for sure, and it'll give you good output.
Right, and okay.
Yeah, and that's a lot easier. Now, if your computer has the right input, and if it doesn't have HDMI, this is a little bit harder. But if it had an HDMI port, it's very likely you could use the Canon. There would be issues. For instance, you don't want to do video for too long on a DSLR because the chip overheats. So it will actually, in some cases, they'll turn off after a certain length of time.
Okay, because a lot of these are 2 hours.
Yeah, see, a T3i would probably not be ideal for that. It would time out to save the battery, so it would go dark all of a sudden. A lot of camcorders do this, too. And because it's not designed, you know, I'm of two minds on this. There are two reasons why DSLRs won't shoot longer videos. One is that the sensor can overheat. And these are not cooled particularly. But the other is, at least in some jurisdictions, if a device can record more than 30 minutes of video, it's taxed differently. I think this is in Europe. So I think a lot of the DSLRs, which could technically go on and on and on, don't, because they don't want to be taxed as a video recorder as opposed to a still camera. That's what I've been told. So, you know what? Get a good Logitech webcam, HD webcam. You'll be much happier. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo. So, during the break, I was kind of curious because I had only dimly remembered this tax. And so I wanted to look it up, and I found the details here. So, digital SLRs, these lovely cameras, like the Canon 5D, for instance, which is a high-end, professional-grade camera, you're spending $1,000. One of the things people have discovered with this is they make excellent video cameras. Because the full-frame sensor is capturing, just as they make great still cameras, really imagine that it's a great video camera. It's better than UHD. They're capturing a lot of pixels. You can use interchangeable lenses, so you can have just great shots, just as you would have great stills. All a video is a bunch of stills put together, right? So you're starting to see movies and TV shows shot on these kinds of cameras. Initially, when the 5D came out, the Mark II, and they added video, and boy, was it amazing. It had a 12-minute limit, and there were two reasons for that. There were two good technical reasons. One, as I mentioned, the chip would overheat. The other was just the way the file system worked on the compact flash card you were recording on. You couldn't record for more than 12 minutes. The file would get too big. In the Mark III, the next generation, Canon responded, and a lot of camera companies have done this, they realized people want to shoot longer video. So they figured out ways to overcome the file size issue by spanning. The video continues, and it just records another file, as every 10, 12 minutes. And the other thing is by cooling the chip, building in, fins, basically, to cool the chip. So they solved the technical limitations, but they still stop recording every 30 minutes. And it turns out this is a regulation in the European Union. It will be taxed at a higher rate as a video camera. Why? Well, you can thank Hollywood for this one. The European Union is taxing video recorders, like home video recorders, like DVRs, like VCRs, at a higher rate. The theory being to compensate for the loss in revenue when people record TV and movies. And I presume Canada does this as well. Recordable CDs came out and DAT discs or DAT tapes, the Canadian government decided to tax them and return a portion of the proceeds to the recording industry to make up for piracy. That's sweet. That's a sweet deal, isn't it? Unclear whether the EU is actually giving that money to the Motion Picture Association of America, but that's why they did it, because of piracy. So if you can't record more than 30 minutes on your DSLR, you can thank the EU and you can thank Hollywood because they're afraid you're going to use it to pirate. You'd think these people are just shaking in their boots all the time. Oh my. Calm down. It's okay. The amount of inconvenience they have caused by this fear. And by the way, do you think a pirate is, oh man, I can't use my 5D to steal movies anymore. I mean, I guess I'll get a video camera. I mean, do you think they're thwarted? Ken, I love this. Cape Girardeau. Is it Mississippi? Cape Girardeau. Is that, am I saying it right, Ken?
It's Cape Girardeau and it's Missouri.
Yeah, Missouri. Cape Girardeau. How are you?
It's the home of Rush Limbaugh, and I just filmed Gone Girl here last year.
So. Gone Girl. Wow. That was filmed there? Oh, wow. Yes, that was a great movie.
That was our claim to fame, yeah. I had a question about, I've got an iMac that's about 5 years old. It was one of the first ones that came out, the newer style, and it's an i7. And I've got a lot of stuff on there, and I was wondering, being an old Windows guy, is it best to, or would it be advantageous to go in there and clear out the hard drive and reinstall the operating system, and or is that not really necessary on a Mac? I have trouble uninstalling some of the programs I've got on there. So
it's never a bad idea. I don't think it's as necessary on a Mac because the Mac doesn't have things like the registry. You know, one of the things about installing an app on Windows is the app doesn't just live in the app folder, in the programs and folder. It lives everywhere. And it gets in the registry and stuff. The Mac doesn't have quite that problem. There are a few special folders, system folders and stuff where apps sometimes install extra stuff. So uninstalling an app isn't as simple on either platform as just dragging the app to the trash. You have to do a little more to uninstall it. So yes, it is true that if you have, you know, over time installed a bunch of stuff and you might have a bunch of cruft living in your system folder. You know, there's an app data folder you can clean out, but it probably isn't a bad idea to reinstall. Recent Macs make it very easy. Just as Windows machines, they have a operating system on the partition of the hard drive. They can also even install over the network. So if you put a whole new hard drive in a Macintosh, you can reboot. I think, is it Command Option R? I can't remember, but you can reboot into a network mount where it will actually go out to Apple's servers and download the operating system and install it over the internet. So it makes it very easy to do this, just like Windows 8 now makes it really easy to do this. So I don't think it's a bad thing. I think once a year, once every few years, I don't find it as necessary on a Macintosh. I've never, you know, Windows really does seem to have a bit rot situation where after a few years, a Windows machine just seems to get sluggish. Because of that, but I don't. I think it's not a bad idea in general, and it certainly doesn't take that long.
I had one other quick question, if you don't mind. I've got I've always bought a Dell XPS i7 for video editing, and been around $1,400-$1,500.
Yep.
I'm really intrigued by going to the Mac Pro, and I know you've got one of those, or you had one anyway.
Yeah. I do.
Is there really that much difference? Will I see that much difference?
No.
No.
In fact, I use a Mac Pro at home, and I like it, but it's not very upgradable compared to a PC. It's kind of an all-in-one system, and everything that you're going to do to add hard drive or capabilities is going to be done externally, if at all. Whereas on a PC, if you get a tower case, upgrades are easy. You know, it's funny, as much as a Mac fanatic as I am, we just, because Apple hasn't really kept their editing solution Final Cut up to date, we've just decided we do a lot of video editing. I have 6 full-time video editors at our podcast network. We have bought each of them a Dell workstation. It's a workstation, high-level workstation, and they're going to be running Adobe Creative Cloud and Premiere as the video editor they're going to move to. So we're moving, ironically, we're moving our video editors from modern, not so modern Macs, Mac Pros from 2010, instead of buying the new Mac Pros, we were moving them to Windows. The truth is, there's not that much difference. They're Intel platforms and stuff. I think the Mac Pro, as beautiful as it is expensive for what you get and is not very upgradable. So for somebody who's a pro video editor, a Mac Pro is probably not the ideal solution.
Okay, appreciate it. Thanks.
You're welcome. I have to be honest. It hurts me. It pains me. And I did buy a Mac Pro for my home, but you buy it more because it's elegant and beautiful. It doesn't even have the latest Intel chips in it anymore. So, remind me, Josh, and I'll give you the specs for the Dell workstations we're putting together. Actually have put together for our editors. High-end GPUs. I think they're dual GPUs because we want to render the video as fast as possible. Fast Xeon processors. Lots of RAM. And less expensive than a Mac Pro. And more upgradable. Brandon in Rancho Santa Margarita, California. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm ready. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I have a quick question for you regarding internet speed.
Yes.
The most I do on my computer and my wife is streaming video from Hulu. What's the minimum internet speed we can get away with using?
You know, I don't know what Hulu demands. Netflix has a very nice little chart where they show what quality you'll get at what speeds. But Hulu, as far as I know, does not do the same thing. But you can imagine it's pretty similar. They're all using kind of similar technologies to render the video. I would say for a good quality stream, you'd probably want 5 megabits down. The problem is what the vendor is selling you may not match what you're getting on a sustained basis. So, for instance, they'll often say speeds up to 20 megabits per second. But if you listen carefully, the words up to mean as maximum 20. What's the minimum? What's the standard? So what you should do is run a speed test. If you go to speedtest.net, you can run a speed test. Get some idea of what the sustained throughput might look like. Because that's, instead of what the vendor told you, that's what you're actually getting. And then remember, if other people are using the internet, that's going to cut it and so forth. So you're running HD video, I presume. You want to, right?
Yeah.
Let me see what Netflix has. In their help center, they have recommendations. They say for HD, 5 megabits per second. For Ultra HD, the 4K stuff, 25 megabits per second. Wow. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by my good buddies, and I mean it, because they saved my life back when I was a freelancer at FreshBooks.com, FreshBooks Cloud Accounting. It makes life much better for the small business, the entrepreneur. If you're still using Word or Excel or Google Docs to create your invoices, you're probably forgetting to mail them or mailing them late. And oh, man, you're just not getting paid if you're not invoicing. FreshBooks is the easiest way to create professional-looking invoices in minutes. They're sent automatically. Your clients can pay easily. In fact, FreshBooks users, on average, get paid 5 days faster. That was my experience, mostly because I kept forgetting to bill people or I'd put it off to next month and that kind of thing. FreshBooks works in multiple currencies. That was nice because I was working in Canada when I first started using FreshBooks, so Canadian dollars, no big deal. FreshBooks has gotten better and better, of course, since now they integrate with all the apps, Google Apps, PayPal, Stripe, MailChimp, Fundbox, Zen Payroll. All the top credit cards are accepted in other online payment systems. So your clients, you know, I think clients do want to pay you. I honestly do. But you got to make it easy for them. FreshBooks does. Another thing that FreshBooks does that's so nice is if your client doesn't pay you, they have the automated payment reminder, so that avoids those embarrassing emails and phone calls. Also, they help you with things like time and hours. In fact, use the great FreshBooks apps on Android or iOS, and you can do it all. Not only invoice, but keep track of time and hours and get them automatically imported into the invoice. You want to keep track of expenses, take pictures of receipts, and that's done. All part of the FreshBooks service. FreshBooks customers spend less time on paperwork. In fact, on average, about 2 days a month they free up. They can focus on the work they love, not the paperwork. Here's one more. FreshBooks customers double their revenue in the first 24 months. Huh? I guess because you're smart enough to be using FreshBooks, you're probably going to be a pretty successful business. FreshBooks, look at this. Tina Roth Eisenberg, founder of Creative Mornings, FreshBooks not only makes me look professional, it saves me a huge amount of time. It's true. Join the 5 million users running their businesses with ease. FreshBooks.com. Your accountant will love it too. Easy reports at tax time. Make this your resolution for 2015. Go to FreshBooks.com/techguy and try it free for 30 days. Do me a favor, though, when they ask you, how'd you hear about us? Tell them you heard it on The Tech Guy. Thank you. FreshBooks.com/Tech Guy. You'll love it. Well, hey, hey, hey. How are you today? Leo Laporte here, The Tech Guy. Time to talk about computers, the internet, smartphones, home theater, digital photography, all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo. I think we all have. All broadcasters have skeletons in their closet, shows they did or things they did that they wish people would just not remember. Somebody tweeted me a link to a show that my good friend Gina Smith did on PBS must be almost 20 years ago now, about the internet. And I, you know, I looked at that, and it's so dated now, of course. And, you know, they start off with her and her co-host driving down the road in a car. And they talk about the information superhighway. Here's a little bit of the audio. From
as we approach the 21st century, a new means of communication is emerging.
What would that be?
This technology uses computer networks to link people on every continent. If we are destined to live in a global village,
we are.
One day we will all be connected to the internet.
Ooh. And now,
okay, some people describe the internet as the prototype for the.
This is Gina, and you have to understand that Gina and her co-host John Levine are driving down the road in a car.
Well, of course it is. But the internet does represent a new form of communication, and this is the best part. You don't have to be a computer geek to take a spin on it.
Oh, boy, were they wrong. Anyway, I watched that with mixed feelings. I was not involved in that production, but when I watched it, I thought, gosh, I hope they never find that show I did for PBS right about the same time. I think it was called Internet Exclamation Mark. Hey, at the time, you know, we felt like everybody needed to understand how the internet worked a little bit better. And they called this show that Gina did Driver's Education for the Information Superhighway. That's kind of what we are. 8880, the internet. 8888, Ask Leo. So computers and the internet, yeah. Although nowadays, we probably spend a lot more time talking about smartphones, home theater. Coming up at half past the hour, our digital photography guru, Chris Marquardt. I love talking about digital photography. Nowadays, it's not so much how technology works and how to figure it out. It's how to integrate it in your life and how to take advantage of it. You know, we don't have to worry about speeds and feeds. We don't care what processors in our smartphone. We just want to make sure it works and use it to make life easier. That's what this show is about. 8888 Ask Leo. Don in Mojave Valley, Arizona. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Leo.
Hey, Don.
How you doing, Leo? How do you complain to a manufacturer using Twitter?
Twitter has become the way to get, if you want customer support, to get customer support, hasn't it? And I think you can blame a guy named Frank Eliason for this. He created a Twitter account called Comcast Cares, which still exists. Frank has long left Comcast, but the at sign is how you indicate a Twitter handle, Comcast Cares. So I'll use that as an example of how you would contact a company. First thing is you have to have a Twitter account. Do you have a Twitter account?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, when you tweet, the way you would communicate specifically to somebody, all tweets are public. Unless they're otherwise indicated, unless they're direct messages. But you want it to be public because the reason people pay attention to complaints on Twitter is because other people might see them.
Correct.
Now, I'll tell you the dirty little secret of this. Probably hardly anybody's going to see it. How many followers do you have on Twitter?
None.
So that's zero people that are going to see it.
I installed it last night.
Right. Right. So really, I mean, when I complain on Twitter, 500,000 people theoretically see it. But what the dirty little secret of Twitter is that probably more than half of those people are not real. They're bots. They're spam bots and things. So a quarter of a million people. And then, unless you're watching, that tweet goes scrolling right by. So, you know, maybe a few thousand people will see anything I put on Twitter. And it's going to be even fewer if you have fewer followers. So, but don't tell the company that. For some reason, companies have decided, gosh, it's public. We can't let this, you know, if somebody's unhappy, we've got to do something about it. So you need to figure out what the company's Twitter account is. Now, in the case of this Comcast, you wouldn't want to tweet to
get hold of Samsung.
All right. So you need to find out what Samsung's Twitter handle is. Now, it may be at sign is how you indicate. Here's a user handle. It may be at sign Samsung, but probably isn't. Is it about a TV or?
No, it's about a washer.
Okay. So I would Google Samsung appliance Twitter and see if they have a special appliances or Samsung support Twitter. You need to figure out which, or you can use them all. You certainly should start with at Samsung.
Which division to get a hold of.
Right? Yeah. See, Samsung right. also makes bulldozers, TVs. I mean, they make everything. So,
right.
you know, gotcha. But I would include at, I bet you at Samsung is also a Twitter account. So I'd always include that. You can have multiple at in there. You just remember the whole total can't be more than 140 characters.
So it's not the hashtag, it's the at.
It's the at. Hashtag is a kind of a search term. So you if you can also use a hashtag Samsung. So then anybody who is searching from Samsung will see it. It doesn't hurt to have both the at. The at is directed at an account. The hashtag says if you're searching for the word Samsung, this is a search term.
Oh, got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Now, I have to say, one of the things that's happened is that companies, you know, a good company, Comcast, Frank used to do this. If you tweeted Comcast cares, where's my rep? He said he'd be here between 2 and 4, and that's 5 p.m. Frank would see this because he's scanning all the time, scanning Twitter for any messages to at Comcast cares, and he would respond, and he'd actually get somebody to roll a truck. Nowadays,
you're talking about this. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. Nowadays, unfortunately, you're more likely to get a cease and desist order. Companies are mean. They're mean. So I think somebody's telling me Samsung Tweets is the handle. Thank you, Scooter X. Good search.
Thanks.
So yes, Samsung. You. So I would do at Samsung Tweets, but also at Samsung. The more the merrier, right?
Absolutely.
Now, they say if you send us a tweet, you consent to letting Samsung use and showcase it in any media. Since I suspect you're going to send them a complaint, I don't think you have to worry about that. you know, this used to work a lot better, but I think companies now are just annoyed, frankly. Somebody in the chat room says, I tweeted Newegg about an unhappy situation with Newegg, and they just canceled my account.
Wow.
So now I don't think this will happen from Samsung. So I think it's absolutely a valid way. Don't be mean. Don't be abusive or you may lose your Twitter account.
Right.
Simply state the facts and say, I'd love some help.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think that's a good thing to do. It's also always a good idea to email Samsung. In fact, email the CEO of the division and let them know as well. Because that sometimes.
Are you posting that right now on your website?
We are posting everything I've just said. We will post thanks to James DeRuvo at techguylabs.com.
Okay, great.
There's also.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Yeah, this is a good technique to know about. At Samsung Support is another one. At Samsung Support. Those are two different accounts. A good company, I think, probably should have somebody who's monitoring that and responding to it. But. The truth is Twitter has changed a little over the last few years. The amount of kind of excessive, for want of a better word, trolling, aggressive, abusive posts has gone way up on Twitter. And I think a lot of companies have decided that the best thing to do is just to kind of shut down complaints instead of fixing them. I know that's happened to me. I've tweeted Comcast and received calls from the executive office saying, can we stop your tweeting? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 88, ask Leo. So I talked earlier in the show about how all of us in broadcasting have, you know, if you've been around long enough, and I've been doing this since 1976, there's little things you did maybe that you're not so proud of that, you know, live on thanks to YouTube and, of course, the chat room. I played the clip of my friend Gina Smith's show about the internet from 20 years ago, and the chat room has found a little documentary about me and then a guy trying to buy a computer and some footage of me from 20 years ago talking about the internet. Let's see if I did I get it right or not.
World Wide Web is an explosive technology. I mean, there's nothing I can think of no other technology that has grown so quickly and been so rapidly embraced by consumers. It's going to change how we work. It's going to change how we are entertained. The concept of a television network is going to dissolve, because what does it mean to have to be NBC when you can broadcast your own shows over the web to everybody? I mean, 500 channels, forget it. They're going to be 500,000 channels.
Bing, ding. I got that one right. So let's we'll do a report card.
You got it on the nose.
I got that one right. That wasn't such a big deal. But remember, this was 1996. I mean, the first internet browser, Netscape, but your widely used browser, Mozilla, came out in 94. Netscape came out around 95 or 96. So this was fairly early on the internet. I was doing at the time, I had just done a television show called The Site, or maybe I was, maybe about to do a television show called The Site, talking about all of this stuff. So it wasn't so prophetic 20 years ago. 8888, Ask Leo. Paul, I have some more from this documentary. It's on YouTube. It's called Of Mouse and Man. And some guy just did it, and I remember doing those interviews for it. Never really went anywhere, but I'd actually wonder what he's up to, too. Let's go back to the phones. Paul in Lake Forest, California. Hi, Paul. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I was listening offline to Heather's travails with her friend's AV system.
We were talking, and I even talked a little bit on the show about understanding how somebody's AV system works. It's not easy.
Yes. Well, my mom doesn't have a really complicated system, but she's getting to the point where complicated things are not to her liking.
Right.
And
I'm at that point, too, by the way.
And her TV system was giving her a little, confusion.
Yeah.
So we basically talked my brother into getting her a Harmony remote.
I think that's a good idea, with some caveats. So,
yes.
First of all, you're going to need to go set it up for her, because if you want complicated, setting up the Harmony is the most complicated thing.
Oh, yeah. I've done that. Matter of fact, in the process of doing it, I went out and I bought my own remote, because I said, this is cool. It works.
Yeah, it does work. There are a few things. I don't use a Harmony. I have a Harmony One, and they have newer ones as well. And I don't use it. It does get rid of all the remotes, which is nice.
Yeah.
And the nice thing that Harmony figured out, Logitech eventually bought them, but when they were first starting out, is, if we just had an online database of all the different equipment, people wouldn't have to – remember, if you've ever programmed a universal remote, you have to figure out – what the commands are. You either put the remotes head-to-head and train them, or there's look up a number in a booklet, and it's just complicated. So Harmony just says, we're going to create a database online that the remote will talk to, you can use. You could actually connect the remote via USB to your computer. I don't think they do that anymore, but you used to be able to do that. Maybe they do.
They do it.
They still do. All right. So you go on the computer, you log into your Harmony account, and you say, "This I have this, this, and this." And now, 10 years in, they have everything. I mean, there's very few. When I first got a Harmony remote, they didn't know about my Proton TV, which was a weirdo TV. Now they know about everything. So that's good. So you just say, you basically online will say, this is our setup. This is what's connected to this. And now the remote knows. It's dumped into the remote. The remote has one button push. You can say, Mom likes to watch Oprah, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I don't think it's Oprah anymore, but whatever. Merv Griffin. Let's push the Merv Griffin button.
You're dating yourself.
Yeah, I really am now. And it will turn on the TV, turn on whatever else needs to be turned on, the satellite box, the cable box, and it'll all work. My problem with it is that nowadays a lot of boxes, there aren't on and off switches. There are toggles. And I've run into this problem a lot, and I wonder if you have too. Where if the TV has to be off for the Harmony program to work.
Yeah, you do have to basically push all off. You want to switch from like Roku to the cable box.
Right.
You got to go all off, all on.
Yeah, because otherwise it turns the TV off. So, and that will really confuse Mom. But if you can figure that out, then I think it's a very good choice.
Well, I mean, all she does is watch TV. I mean, she's...
It's pretty simple, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I love the Harmony remotes. I think they're great. It's and I think that that insight that they had put them on top, which is you don't have to train the remote. We'll have a database.
It's also a nice thing to do if you have a friend who's staying with you.
It is.
Just put this one remote out on the coffee table.
I'll drag mine out. I have it. I should probably set it up again and do it. It just bugged me that I had to have everything in a known state before it would work. I had to turn everything off first. That seems like an extra step that's a little annoying. But that's not Harmony's fault. It's because most TVs now, they don't have an on switch and an off switch. They just have a toggle. Whatever I am now, do the other.
Yeah, actually, it depends upon the device, but like there is actually, you can call up the individual buttons, and there is like...
Some have an off switch.
Power off and power toggle. So a lot of devices have three different powers.
I wish they would do that. That's a good tip to all the television manufacturers. Remember, we want to use remotes, universal remotes, so please, could you have an off button? We don't want just a toggle. We want an on button and an off button. I appreciate it. That's a good tip. And which one did you get?
That was the 650. It was the only one that was in stock right before Christmas.
Yeah.
The 650.
Yeah. Yeah. 650. That's good.
Yeah.
All right. I appreciate it. You remind me I should do this.
Well, good. I accomplished two things.
Thanks for the tip, Paul. I appreciate it. Chip in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Hi, Chip. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
Hey, Chip.
Hi. Last year I went to AVN. This year I'm not going. So my friend is arguing with me, saying, you know, I'm going to miss out on a lot of the convention center. So I'm using you as an example.
Always risky to use me as an example. You want to know why? You said AVN, the Adult Video Expo?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Well, I'm not a good example for that. I try to stay away from that every year.
Well, it's for CES. Ah. I'm trying to make the analogy.
Right.
I think conventions are in the past.
I don't know if adult video conventions. I don't know if AVN is the same as CES. You know, for a while they were at the same time. And actually in the earliest days, and was it CES or Comdex? One of them, the adult video section was in the actual convention. I think probably it was CES. There'd be a whole adult area, which was very embarrassing to all involved. So what the folks at CES said is, we're going to throw you out. You have your own convention. The AVN folks said, well, we'll have it at the same time so that if you're and if you think about it, if you're a consumer electronics dealer and you sell TVs and stuff, you have VCRs, you might actually have a little video section. Maybe you have an adult video section. So they had it at the same time. Now they've separated. They're not at the same time. So, but I'll answer your question. Why did I not go to CES when we come back? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, look who's here, speaking of Kodachrome. It is Chris Marquardt, our photo guy. Chris joins us most weeks to talk about digital photography. Hello, Chris.
Oh. Yo, how are you?
Last
time I had a hairdo like this, I think I was 16 or 17.
You're talking about my shaved head?
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah. I like it.
It's cold. I shaved it for charity. That's all I can say. That's my only excuse. But, yeah, you haven't seen. That's right. You haven't seen me since New Year's Eve. That's when I shaved it.
You did a good thing there.
We raised $75,000 for UNICEF.
Whoa.
I'm pretty happy.
That's amazing.
It, you know, and the hair will grow back. So it's not.
Oh yes, it will.
Yeah. So Chris, what do you want to talk about today?
Ah, you know, it's the beginning of the year, and a lot of listeners might have just received their new camera for Christmas, and maybe for some it's kind of the first time they're actually holding a proper camera, you know, like a big one where you can change lenses. So I want to throw all the stuff we talked about out of the window and just talk to those who are really new in the field and who want to kind of make the best of it, you know, tell you how to avoid the first stumbling blocks.
Great.
So first stumbling block is, and I'm not going to be very technical here, is the camera's pretty smart. You know, it gets the exposure right usually, and the exposure is how bright the image is, until it doesn't. Then you go, what is going wrong? Well, first of all, there's nothing wrong putting your camera into fully automatic mode. The camera will, in 90% of all cases, will probably do a good job guessing what you're shooting and then adjusting the exposure right. But then sometimes it is better to tell the camera what you're shooting. So you can do this by using any of the, you know, there are these little, these modes that you can set the camera to for sports or candlelight or night shots and these kind of things. Mm-hmm. If you're starting out with a camera, that's a good place to start. That'll give you better pictures in those situations where the camera cannot guess what you're doing. And if you want a bit of the advanced version, then ditch those modes, go to something like aperture priority or shutter priority or program mode. Manual, nah, that's too advanced probably, but the other modes, the little P, the little A, the little S on this dial, and learn about exposure compensation. That's kind of the advanced version of that.
Should I worry about shooting JPEG or Camera Raw? I think a lot of people hear us talk about Camera Raw and go, oh, I need to do that.
When you're starting out, don't.
Don't even bother.
Leave the camera on JPEG.
JPEG's fine.
set to JPEG.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is with JPEG, you get a picture that is already developed. The camera will work on the colors and tweak things a bit and make it look nice and give you a nice blue sky, if there is a blue sky, and try to not make it a green sky. And if you shoot RAW, you have to work a bit more on the pictures. So that's kind of the next level.
Yeah. I would think of learning how to use a new camera or learning how to use a more serious camera than you've used before is what I'd call an iterative process. Start simple.
Absolutely.
Put it on iAuto and just push it halfway down to focus, just like your point and shoot. Take the picture by pushing it the rest of the way and take a lot of pictures. That's going to be helpful. And then as you start, you do that. Now you can start to look at the manual and look and see what these other settings and buttons do. And I think you nailed it. You should start with P, and then you can look at S and A and maybe the picture mode. Start to expand into the capabilities of the camera. But not at first. Don't try to learn it all at once because it's overwhelming.
Oh, it'll be overwhelming. It'll be frustrating because then you have so many things to look for that you will miss the actual shots. I mean, what you're taking pictures of is actually even more important. Second thing are the colors. Colors are sometimes off. Sometimes the camera will not get the tone right, and that usually has to do with the light source. So you have maybe under artificial lights, that can happen quite easily. Under tungsten lights, sometimes pictures come out too orange, too red. Under fluorescent lights, sometimes the pictures might come out with a green tint. And your camera has little presets built in, like a little symbols, little cloud symbol for a cloudy sky, a little light bulb symbol for a tungsten light, a little fluorescent light symbol for fluorescent lights. And if you set the camera to those little presets, you will have much better colors than if you let the camera decide what it wants to do. It'll be, again, 90% okay if you leave it on automatic there. But if you start getting the colors wrong, look at these little presets, and they'll pretty much guarantee that you get a good color picture.
Great.
And then the advanced version of that would be custom white balance. Look it up in the manual. It's even more precise, but again, not in the first year of shooting. Take your time. Use those little presets, and you'll be just fine.
Yeah. I think this is good. I think that sometimes people get so overwhelmed. It seems so complicated that they just put it aside and don't use it. They go back to their old camera. So it's always nice to start simple and work your way up to the more complicated things. It's nice to also have a roadmap to know what's going to be next and next and next. And don't worry about flashes yet or any of that stuff.
No, don't. Yeah. And obviously the last thing is completely non-technical, and that's about composition, about how to compose a picture. Maybe with a bit more of a serious camera, you might want to look into a bit more of a serious image composition, maybe think a bit more where you put things in the picture. And just the most important tip, get closer. Frame with what you want to shoot. Yeah. Make sure the viewer will know what the picture's about. So get closer and, fill the frame.
That's true, though, for any kind of camera, even a simple and expensive $100 point and shoot. Get closer. Fill the frame. Unless you're taking a picture of the Eiffel Tower, then, you know.
Well, then get as close as you have to fill the picture with the Eiffel Tower.
It
kind of applies to everything.
You don't want to see a little Eiffel Tower. Yeah, get a big Eiffel Tower. Chris Marquardt teaches this stuff. Actually, your Tips from the Top Floor this week is fun, and everybody should listen to it. What was the subject? I remember noting that, and I don't remember.
Oh, it was the hit me with your selfie stick.
Selfie sticks.
It's about smartphone photography, and yes, I talk about selfie sticks
That's right. Absolutely wonderful. TTF. I'd forgotten temporarily, but I remember now. TFTTF.com. That's Tips from the Top Floor. Or just go to discoverthetopfloor.com. You'll see not only Chris's podcasts, which are fabulous in both German and English, by the way, but also his workshops, lots of good ones all the time, and a lot of his photos, too. And some wonderful photo sets. I think you're doing the best work you've ever done, frankly. Just great stuff.
I'm happy with what I'm doing right now. Yep.
Isn't that nice? Thank you, Chris. Chris Marquardt. Discoverthetopfloor.com. It's very gemütlich in his new studio, whatever that means. Thank you, Chris. Take care.
Sure.
8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go. Actually, I was going to tell Chip and Cherry Hill, who wanted to explain to his friends why he wasn't going to the adult video forum, the adult video conference, why I didn't go to CES. It's not comparable. But mostly, in fact, I think you'll see this frequently with people who are older journalists who have perhaps achieved the higher ranks of the tech journalism sphere. They often send their minions to CES. CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, which has just concluded in Las Vegas, is out of control. I mean, you've got to go once, even if you're not a journalist. If you're just interested, sneak in. Find a way in, because it's amazing. 160,000 people, many, many, many acres of exhibits. Two of our reporters who went down there, Scott Wilkinson, walked 28 miles in 4 days. Dick DiBartolo walked 19 miles in 4 days. I mean, that's the kind of thing you have to do. And it's frequently people get sick there because there's so many people. On the other hand, it's a great place to see all the latest and greatest. I just feel like on the internet, I can see almost all of it. So I send people for me. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. We're talking high tech. I was at the beginning of the hour talking about old videos about the internet. And I was pleased somebody in the chat room found a documentary that I was a part of in 1996. Man, as a young broadcaster, actually, I was already been 20 years in the business, but back in 1996, was doing a computer talk show very much like this one in San Francisco, and he had asked me about some of the more modern technologies, and I think this clip, I am pretty proud of this clip. This is from Of Mouse and Man, a documentary. You can find it on YouTube. I'm holding up a Newton.
These little PDAs like this, within 3 years, you're going to have as much power in this thing or more than you do in a desktop computer. You'll be able to talk to it. That might not be 3 years. That might be 10 years. But you'll be able to talk to it. It'll talk back to you. It'll be connected via wireless technologies to everything, your bank account, emails, movie schedules. So it's silly to say, well, what kind of desktop computer should I buy? Because in a few years, you're going to want one of these. And then in a few years after that, you're going to want a smaller one.
As usual, the time frame might have been a little bit off. That was 1996. The iPhone came out about 12 years later. No, 11 years later. So I guess I was kind of close, a decade, before we had a portable handheld device that was connected at all times to the internet that you could talk to. Pretty close. And those are the, and I think this is the case today, these are the computers we use more than any other. Your desktop computer isn't as important as it used to be, is it? It's your handheld computer. And I guess when I first saw the Newton, I kind of said, gee, you know, if this were only connected to the internet, everything would change. 8888 Ask Leo. Matthew, Diamond Bar, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Matthew.
Hey, Leo. How you doing today?
I'm well. How are you?
Not too bad. It's a little bit of rain down here in Southern California, but we definitely need it, so no complaints.
Yes. Rain good, California. Rain good.
But here's something else putting a damper on my day. I have about a 4 or 5 year old Asus laptop, and it would just kind of restart automatically, like not really through the Windows update, but when it restarted, it would come back to like that DOS screen where it was like the safe mode or start Windows.
Yeah,
mode.
That's normal. Windows does that. In fact, it probably gave you a message. Windows did not shut down properly.
It's like the black screen with the white letters.
Yeah, it does that because it crashed. Or it rebooted, and when it reboots, it wants you to know, hey, I rebooted in the middle of something. You may have lost data. Maybe you want to check the disk. That's a safety precaution. You can safely ignore that and continue on. What you want to do, and I know this is why I'm sure this is why you call, is figure out why it's doing that.
Yeah, at first I thought it was the battery because it said it may be trying to replace it. I bought a new battery, but even when it's plugged in full power, it's still doing it, and it's just it does it like every 10 minutes or once or twice a day. It's just at random. Like there's some critter inside there that says, hey, let's flip the switch on this guy, you know?
My first thought is it's overheating. It's a 5-year-old laptop. Laptops overheat anyway. You know, there's a lot of stuff crammed into a small space. And as they get older, fans maybe stop working or don't work as efficiently. There's more dust inside, which actually acts like insulation, like a blanket. So my first thought is maybe it's overheating.
So that's how I can say to a guy to blow out, basically?
Yeah. I mean, you might even be able to do this if you can easily remove the outer case. Be careful. Don't, you know, start disconnecting stuff. But if you can kind of get to the motherboard, you might be able to see some dust in there. Clean that out. Tech would be able to open it up and look at the fans, make sure they're performing properly. The other thing that happens is part of the cooling system is a fan usually right on the CPU, on the chip that's doing all the thinking. That is a very high source of heat. That fan is connected to the CPU by a thin film of paste, of heat transfer paste. That can dry out after a while and not be as effective. So often we see these overheating situations with older computers because of all of those things. So it is the first thing I'd leap to. And there could be other issues. It could be a power supply internally, not the external, but the internal power supply is flaky or failing. It could be a lot of things. But the first thing I would look at is overheating. That is a very common problem. Okay. And if it's the thermal paste, that's not a user fixable part. You'd have to get a tech to go in there, remove the fan, reapply thermal paste to put it back on. But a tech should be able to do this if you find a good one. That's the challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, I try to stay more the independents than the big box people.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. What you really want is the shade tree mechanic of techs. You know, the guy who's really an expert in this stuff and does it because he loves it and he enjoys it, makes a little, you know, maybe it's his job. It's probably not a great living. What you don't want is the, you know, $10 an hour kid that got a week's worth of training at the Best Buy boot camp and is now using a notebook to figure out what to do. That's not what you want. You want an enthusiast.
Right.
Good luck finding him. But if you can find him, man, keep him. Because those guys, it's the same. It's probably not much different than an auto mechanic. You know, you want a guy who really knows and loves this stuff. And that guy's going to know and is going to say the same thing I said. Well, yeah, could be you got a little dust in there. Fan could have died. Do you feel heat coming out of the thing? Can you see the fan working?
No more than normal. I mean, it's sitting on a desk. I don't have one of those little fans underneath it or on a pedestal or anything. I just keep it on the desktop.
Sometimes the BIOS, you know, that setup black screen before you launch Windows, you can press, you know, escape, delete, F8, depends on the machine, to get into BIOS setup. Sometimes in there they have temperature sensors. But the problem is by the time you get to it, it's cooled down a lot. It doesn't take more than a few seconds to cool off. So sometimes you can't always tell. There are programs. Look for CPU ID. Go to that site and you can find a program that I think it's called Motherboard Monitor that you can run on a Windows machine that'll look at the sensors and give you an idea of the temperatures. There's all sorts of things you can do. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I listen as often as I can, so I appreciate
the help. I appreciate it. Thank you for listening. Yeah, and this is unfortunately one of the things that happens as systems get older. It's too bad because the chip's not going to wear out. A solid-state processor, the microprocessor, that doesn't wear out. Moving parts wear out. That's what wears out. Physical stuff, hard drives. There are a lot of things that could cause this, but heat is almost always the first thing to look at. Diane in West L.A., Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Well, I have a very old IBM ThinkPad that basically came over on the Mayflower, and I came about the same time. So this is
the Pilgrim Pad.
The Pilgrim Pad. So anyway, and I'm very basic. I don't even have a TV anymore. I'm not a person for like that kind of thing. But I miss my laptop because I like to Google and look at the news. And
you know what I would look at now?
But I want something with a keyboard and everything. I don't.
Yeah.
Want, that's why I don't want all that.
You don't want a tablet. The next step.
I don't want a tablet.
No, the next step up is a Chromebook. And these are great for people who really, they want email, they want internet access. They're not, you know, writing novels, although you could.
I'm a Google queen.
You're a Google queen. Well, the Chromebook is from Google. So it's the Google Chrome OS. It is a Chrome browser. They are $200 to $300. There's some really excellent ones out there now. Look for a late model. Samsung makes some good ones. Acer, Asus.
Now, what I want to know about, how is the screen on this? Because I'm, you know, I'm a...
Well, go look at them. Go to a Best Buy or somewhere and look at them and pick one that you're right on a $250 computer. The screens aren't going to be great, so look for the ones that have. But some have better screens. You know what I should do? There's so many new ones. I'll give you. I'm going to do a little research to find out which screens are the best. I had an Acer C720. That was my favorite. They're a little small.
Yeah, see, I don't want anything too small because on top of being not old, I have farsighted.
So right. You want a big screen.
Like, I don't look at little tiny things, yeah. You know.
Well, there are other choices. The nice thing about the Chromebook is it's simple. It's not Windows. It's not Macintosh. It's simple. It's a browser. You already know how to use it. It's very secure. If anything goes wrong, it's a simple thing to fix.
Yeah, I use the computer at work, but I know how to do a Microsoft Word and all that sort of
stuff. Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know. I just don't want the Apple kind of stuff.
But you want a bit. Yeah, yeah, I understand. And you may not want Windows either. That's a lot of complexity you don't need.
Like a regular computer, I'd want 7. I don't want to do this 8.
Yeah.
Windows.
Well, as I said, with the Chromebook, you're not getting Windows. You're getting just the browser. But that makes everything a lot simpler. And since that sounds like what you're mostly using, I think that'd be a good choice. Otherwise,
I like using Microsoft Word and my printer, but they won't hook up, and I don't want to buy one again.
I think, though, you want a bigger screen than is available. So you want, it sounds like, how big is the screen right now on your computer?
Oh, I have no idea. I haven't used it for a while. I finally just threw it in the
closet
and blew up. But I love that. Oh, I didn't think they had the color. Was gorgeous on the screen.
Yeah, the ThinkPads are great. They're expensive. I mean, if money is not an issue, then I think it's Lenovo makes them now. They bought the ThinkPad brand from IBM, and there's some excellent Lenovos. But you can also attach a Chromebook to an external monitor and get it 27 inches if you want. Let me think about this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, a Chromebox. There you go. I'm going to make a bet with you. I bet you have hundreds of dollars just sitting in your drawers right now gathering dust. You might say, well, that's crazy, Leo. Why would I just leave money lying around in my drawers? Well, if you're leaving gadgets lying around, those gadgets are worth cold hard cash at gazelle.com. Now's the time to turn your old iPhones or Samsung phones, your tablets from Microsoft, Apple, all these great products that you once loved so much and now are just gathering dust, turn them into cash at gazelle.com. All your Gazelle quotes are guaranteed for 30 days, so it's even risk-free just to get the quote right now, and do that sooner than later because, frankly, that gadget's not getting more valuable. It's only getting less valuable. They'll pay you with a check, a PayPal credit, or an Amazon gift card, and they bump the Amazon gift card up by 5%. Find out why Gazelle is so beloved by so many people. 2 million plus trade-ins for more than $200 million paid out to customers. $200 million. And 9 out of every 10 say, we had a great experience. We had an excellent, not just great, excellent experience. By the way, if you wonder where do the gadgets go, the very best of the gadgets, the creme de la creme, they sell them on Gazelle.com. This is a new program, the Gazelle Certified Pre-Owned Gadget Program. If you've lost your phone or your kids broke their phones and you don't want to buy them a brand new one, go here first for a great price on a certified pre-owned iPhone, Samsung Galaxy phone, or iPad. They, of course, put every device through a 30-point rigorous inspection, and you do have a 30-day risk-free return policy, so there's no risk at all. There are two conditions, certified like new, which is like new, or certified good, which means there's a little gentle signs of wear. Probably better than the device you lost or broke, but you'll save a whole lot more money. It is a great deal. G-A-Z-E-L-L-E, to sell, to buy, gazelle.com. What's your iPhone worth? Take a minute and go to gazelle.com and find out right now. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo's the number. The question, I love the last question because it is really a question more people should be asking. I want to get on the internet. I want to read email. I want to watch videos on YouTube. I want to watch Netflix movies. I want to do a lot of things that you would think I need a computer to do. But do I really need a Windows computer? Do I really need even a Mac computer? Maybe there's something better, simpler, less expensive. And there is. There really is. Tablets, one of the reasons iPads have taken off. Tablets are great. Now, our last caller wanted a keyboard, completely reasonable. And, of course, you can use a keyboard with a tablet. All the tablets will allow you to use Bluetooth keyboards, keyboards that connect via Bluetooth, not physically, to type on them. But tablet screens are small, 10 inches. They're, you know, they're maybe a little harder to see. The next step up from a tablet, and I'm really more and more a fan of this, is the Chromebook. This is an operating system created by Google called Chrome OS. It's basically the Chrome browser, and that's it. Chromebooks are designed to be cloud computers. That is, and they're very good, very adept at internet, but there's not a lot of storage in them. They usually come with 100 gigabytes or more of storage on the Google Cloud, so you're expected to keep your documents and so forth there. You can do many of the things you do with a real computer because Chrome is designed to add extensions that are very powerful. They're virtually apps. In fact, Chrome is going to move more and more towards kind of an app store model, I think, and become a full-fledged operating system in that sense. So I think that's a good choice for a lot of people. Schools are going crazy with Chromebooks. This is a very popular choice for schools because they're inexpensive. Kids can't get in trouble on them. They can really basically do their homework and not much else. That's just what you want. They don't get viruses. They don't have any of the security issues that a full-blown Windows or Mac would have. The Chromebooks have been so successful that the folks who make Windows computers have kind of started to respond with, you might call it Netbooks 2.0, the latest generation of inexpensive laptop computers. Started with the HP Stream. Stream is an amazing thing. It's a $200, $250 computer that's just really pretty good. Not great, but pretty good. Pretty usable. A lot of other companies have come up with similar solutions, seeing the success of the HP Stream. And Microsoft has encouraged this by offering low-cost Windows licenses. If you're getting something that has Windows with Bing, if that's the name of it, that's a very low-cost Windows solution. So for our last caller, if you're really a Windows, you really do know Windows, you like Windows, you use Windows at work, and you'd like a bigger screen, you certainly could look at maybe a 15-inch HP Stream or something similar. It'll be a lot less expensive than a Lenovo. But it is Windows, and that's that. You still have to install security updates. It's still prone to catching a virus because most viruses are written to attack Windows machines. So you don't get the benefits of something like Chrome OS or a tablet. 8888 Ask Leo. Larry's on the line. Hesperia, California. Hi, Larry. Leo Laporte.
Hey, Leo. How are you doing?
I am well. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm trying to decide if I need to toss this computer or if there's any way to save it. I have about a 7-year-old Toshiba laptop, the only computer I've ever owned. It's always served me very well. But about a week ago, the screen stopped lighting up. When I turn it on, I can hear it running.
Yeah.
I can't turn it back off once it's been turned on.
You may find even if you tilt the screen just right, you can actually see something on the screen. What often happens with older laptops like that is the backlight goes out. Now, it could be something else, but this is the first thing to do is try to get it in sunlight and angle it and see if you can actually read a screen. Without a backlight, you can still read LCD screens, but you have to have the lighting condition has to be just right. If it really is black, 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 there's nothing there, then it could be something very easy to fix. The hinge, as you know, when you open and close a laptop, it's a hinge. And in the hinge, there's a ribbon cable that comes up from the motherboard of the computer, the logic board on the bottom base of the computer that goes up into the screen.
Okay.
If that, and after 7 years, wouldn't be surprised if that's worn or frayed or broken.
Okay.
And that would make a dark screen. You can test this even by if the laptop, and most Toshibas of that era had a VGA port. If the laptop has a VGA port, getting a VGA monitor, plugging it in, and if you can see it, then the laptop's fine. It's just the screen on the laptop that's bad.
Can I add one more thing to this equation here?
Yeah.
It almost seems like the switch is bad to me because also with the screen not illuminating, the little indicator button, when you push caps lock or numbers lock, usually will come on. Those won't light up either. And on my front, on the front leading edge here, it's got those five little indicator lights that come on. The fourth one to the left, I'm reading here, it says internal storage drive light. That's not lighting up either.
Oh.
And like I said, once it's on, I can't turn it back off.
Yeah.
It seems like a bad switch to me. I don't know.
Well, it could be bad power supply. It's interesting because you feel like something's coming on.
Absolutely. It's running right now. I'm looking at it. I was hoping you'd tell me what button to push to magically light it up.
Well, when you say you're looking at it, there's nothing to see, though, right?
Right. I mean, the computer is in front of me, and it's on and running.
And
right
what
now.
You're hearing, it could just be fans.
Yes, I think it is.
Okay, so maybe the computer is dead and the fans are going on.
Although, I don't know what this means, but it almost sounds like when you first turn it on, you know that sound a computer makes? It almost sounds like a transmission shifting gears.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does that.
That's the floppy seat.
I believe it's on.
Do you have a floppy in there?
No.
No?
No.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the truth is a 7-year-old laptop's worth about $1.50.
Okay.
I mean, it's pretty old. Laptops, you know, typically don't last as long as desktops, and even a 7-year-old desktop at this point would be pretty old. So, you know, it might be worth replacing. The problem is fixing it might cost hundreds of dollars, and I don't think it's worth $100 to fix.
No, no.
So I guess you're asking me, is there something easy I can check to see? The first thing I do is get a VGA cable and plug it in, if you had one lying around or your friend does, a VGA monitor, and just see if there's anything on the screen. That would tell you then, oh, yeah, it's just the ribbon cable on the computer on the laptop screen, and I could probably fix that for 10 cents.
Oh.
But it doesn't sound like it's that because those other lights aren't coming on.
Yeah.
Sounds like it might be dead. Maybe just the fans that's coming on.
Oh, okay.
So it doesn't sound optimal. And the problem is at this point, it's old enough that it's not worth fixing. Right? You're not going to put $200 into it to fix it.
No, I'm not.
I would try another display before I'd give up on it completely. If you can see something on the other display, then it's just a display issue. If the second display on VGA just doesn't come on and you can't get in a BIOS, you're going to have to bring it to a shop. Somebody's not going to look at it unless you give them $150 up front.
Yep.
They're not even going to look at it.
Yeah.
So at that point, I think it's time for a new one.
I made this brief phone call, Leo.
Yes, I think the doctor has decided to call it.
Okay.
Let's call it. 1:13 on a Sunday afternoon. It expired.
I'll recycle this thing into computer heaven immediately.
Thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Jared in Whittier, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Jared.
Hi, Leo. I'm having a problem with my iPhone 5.
All right.
The Wi-Fi and LTE are kind of become a lot more spotty since upgrading to iOS 8.
Welcome to the wonderful world of iOS 8.
Yes.
That is true. You just made a true statement. Wi-Fi is worse on iOS 8, and Apple's been trying to fix this. They can't go backwards at this point, unfortunately. You're committed. Have you gone all the way to 8.1.2, the latest version?
I have, and it did seem a little bit better, but I'm still having some problems, and I don't know what to do. I would like to, if I could, I'd like to go back to iOS 7, I'm not really sure what to do.
You can't, unfortunately, because Apple has stopped signing iOS 7, so there's no downgrade available. But there are known Wi-Fi issues, and there are, in some cases, workarounds. So we'll talk when we come back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo, the website techguylabs.com. Always free, no sign up. Just go read, enjoy every show, audio and video, all the questions, all the answers, and your comments too. Techguylabs.com. Wi-Fi, so funny. You'd think it would be more stable. It's been around for a long time now, it's kind of well known. We've slowly improved it. We started with 802.11, which was the original very slow Wi-Fi nobody had. Then there was 802.11b. That was great. Remember that? That was the first, you know, fast Wi-Fi. Then they came out with 802.11a, which wasn't really widely adopted. It was used mostly for multimedia and that kind of thing. 802.11g came out after that. Oh, even faster, even better. Should be getting better and better, right? More and more reliable. Then N. We skipped a few. I don't know what happened to HIJKLM, but we went to 802.11n. And the current version, which is should be ratified this year, but I think you're starting to see it pretty commonly everywhere, is 802.11ac. And it has even more cool, neat, fine features. In each case, it's been getting faster and supposedly more robust. 802.11ac has some really interesting features. Has to be supported in hardware, but it has something called beamforming. once a Wi-Fi access point sees another Wi-Fi device and they start a conversation, then the access point starts to aim its signal at that thing, at that laptop or the phone, and the signal gets better. There's all sorts of cool stuff in there. So why is it 802.11, whatever, is working less well in many, many instances? Certainly on OS X Yosemite, the newest version of OS X, big Wi-Fi problems. iOS 8, big Wi-Fi problems, which Apple claims to fix with each revision and hasn't. Microsoft's having the similar problems on Windows. The Surface Pro 3, terrible Wi-Fi issues, which took them a long time to fix, and some say haven't been fixed yet. Now, one of the reasons Wi-Fi is more problematic is because there's more Wi-Fi users. The signals are much more crowded than they used to be. That's a big problem. I think maybe the single most, I mean, that's what's changed, right? Everything's gotten better. The routers have gotten, maybe the routers are aging. Maybe some of us should be getting new routers, perhaps, to because aging routers could be part of the problem. But I also think that more congestion and this has changed, this has gone away, but for a while, and maybe you've experienced this, they were selling these super Wi-Fi routers. They would eat all the signal up. They'd eat all the bands. And your Wi-Fi would be great, but it would kill your neighbor's Wi-Fi. I think there are a few of those still around, too. So there have been, you know, as more people use it, it's an unregulated frequency, 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz. Those are wide open, and more things are using them than ever before. I think maybe that's why. I don't know. I don't know. But I just noticed that everybody's having more trouble. So on iOS 8, there are a few things you should try. For instance, if you go into your settings on your iPhone or your iPad, go to General and then Reset and Reset Network Settings. Some say that helps. Certainly, it's a simple thing to try. It won't cause any problems. So reset your network settings. Try going, if you're in a crowded arena, you might want to mess with the channel that your Wi-Fi access point and your device are using. Normally, those are auto-configured, but you might want to get a Wi-Fi analysis tool and look and see where the congestion is. It often helps, and I do this at home, to go from 2.4 gigahertz to 5 gigahertz. If you have a 5 gigahertz router, you can do that. It should improve it to go from G to N or from N to AC to get the more recent protocol. Should help. Should is a big, that's a big should there. Lots of people complaining. Lots of people complaining about Wi-Fi on iOS 8. And I don't think there's a blanket fix. Apple's had Wi-Fi problems, frankly, since the iPad came out. I remember the days, 2011, when college campuses were banning iPads, saying you can't use them on our network because they screw our network up. But the source of the problem and the fix, not well known. So, Jared, all I can say is, you know, try resetting the settings. You cannot go to iOS 7. Apple has blocked that route. They stopped signing iOS 7, which means there's no downgrade possible. You're stuck. You're with iOS. And by the way, if you're listening and you haven't yet upgraded, you might want to wait. If everything's working, you might want to wait till somebody gives the all clear. Marty in Simi Valley, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Marty. How you doing, Leo?
I'm well. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Well, this week I was going to go buy a 79-inch Sony X900B ultra-high-def TV.
Nice.
And then I heard your report about CES.
Yeah. Don't ever, don't, you know. Oh, you see, you had a nice TV, and now we blew it for you.
Yeah, see, I don't have any TVs now. I've remodeled my house. Everything's wired.
Everybody loves, by the way, everybody loves this X900. It's a gorgeous TV, but that was right until CES.
Right.
So what's, and by the way, that's a 20, is it a $25,000 TV you're talking
about? No, that's the 85 inch. This is only 8,000 now.
Only 8,000, okay.
Yeah, 6 months ago it was right around 15.
Holy cow. Yeah. So here's the deal. I think what you're saying is what we talked about with Scott Wilkinson on the last show, which is there is now a standard for UHD.
Correct.
And this older TV, this older UHD TV, will not be conformed to the standard in all likelihood.
No, but Samsung and Sony are saying that they're guaranteeing that their TVs currently out with 4K will...
What are they guaranteeing? They'll work. No one said they won't work.
They said they will work with...
They'll work. That's not the issue.
...standards in 2 years.
They will work. Of course, no one's going to make a standard that will break backward compatibility.
Right.
The question is, will it look as good as it could if you had bought one that was up to the standard? So right. One of the things about the standard is the decision about what the color space should be. Now that they've settled on a color space, a TV that adheres to that standard will have the best color range, better perhaps than an older TV that didn't know what the standard was going to be. So I'm not the expert. I don't know, and I think this is one for Scott Wilkinson. Samsung has announced new UHD TVs that will conform to the new standard, but whether the old Sony will or won't, I don't know. You know, maybe Sony said we're going to...
It will, too.
Well, what... They're saying more than it will work optimally?
Well,
we know it'll work. That's not the issue.
Right.
It's not the issue. We know it'll work. Nobody's going to break that. But whether it will work as well as it could. And I don't know how you're going to know this. This will shake out in time. You know what? That is a nice TV. I don't think you're going to be unhappy with that TV. And if you don't have a TV now, I don't think you should delay, because even the TVs that we know will work won't be out till the fall. So, you know, my suggestion, buy this TV. You, even if it didn't work optimally, you probably wouldn't notice the difference. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo. That's the number. If you have a question, a comment, suggestion. It's a little difficult right now to know. The dust has not yet cleared from CES. Whether it's worth waiting for the UHD TVs that have been announced, you'll be waiting for 6 months at least, or whether you should buy a TV today. But I think with our caller, with Marty, who didn't have a HD TV at all, if you can afford an $8,000 TV, this is a TV everyone agrees is a great TV. It's a lot better than no TV. I guess the question that's really difficult to answer at this point is whether you should get an HD or a UHD TV. And I think still there's not a lot of UHD content, so you'd probably be all right with an HD TV, especially if it's not giant. 70 inches and you're 10 feet away, you probably wouldn't see much difference between UHD and HD. Frankly, I was watching movies on my DVD player last night on my HD TV, and they looked pretty good. I could tell the difference. A little softer is how they looked. They didn't look bad, though. Certainly tolerable. It's the difference between standard definition and HD was big. That was like you needed glasses, and you put them on, and wow, the world looks clear and crisp. It's not such a big jump to UHD. It looks good, but it doesn't look twice as good. Looks a little bit better. Be nice to have a good TV, though. So I would certainly look at an HD TV. I think you've obviously looked at the reviews. People love this Sony Bravia. Nice one to go with, I think. If you can afford it, why not? Live it up. A number of people are telling me that the Acer Chromebook 15, which is a 15-inch Chromebook, is an excellent choice for somebody who wants a good display. This was announced at CES. Wants a good display, but it wants to have the simplicity and the lower cost of a Chromebook. Acer makes excellent hardware, I think. And, in fact, they made my favorite Chromebook, the C720, but that's 2 years old now. The Chromebook 15 from Acer. It's the first 15-inch Chromebook. It seems to be a good one to look at if you're looking for that. That is an HD display on that Chromebook. And $250. Wow. Lauren in Aliso Viejo, California.
Oh, how are you doing?
Hi, Lauren. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Yeah, I have a laptop, and I've had it for maybe about 5 years, but all of a sudden, just recently, it started showing green horizontal lines.
Ew.
And then they would disappear and whatnot. So I backed up my computer, and then we restored it back to factory when we bought it.
But it didn't get better, did it?
No, because now every time I go to turn it on, it either says it's installing one of 66 updates or one of 15 updates.
But did the green lines go away?
Well, on this new one, since I restored it, I'm not seeing the green lines anymore, but every time I turn the computer on...
Yeah, you know, I understand that, but I'm amazed the green lines went away. Green lines usually mean you've got a hardware problem with your display. So a reinstall of Windows wouldn't normally fix that. So now I'm baffled, because the tech guy, if you'd asked him, would have said, oh, you need a new laptop, that display's gone bad. All right, but I'll help you with the other issue, since it sounds like... unaccountably installing Windows again fixed it.
Except it must have. I haven't seen a green line.
You don't see green lines, except that you can't finish the install.
Correct.
And that's very important. When you reinstall Windows, and you reinstalled it from the disk that came with the laptop, I take it?
Yes.
Yeah, so that disk was old, right? And the laptop is the same age as the laptop. And since then, Microsoft has released at least 68 updates. So and it's really important that you install all those updates, because otherwise you're vulnerable to the security flaws those updates fixed. It's kind of an interesting thing. Microsoft does these every second Tuesday of the month, and effectively that's an announcement. The hackers all sit up, they wake up, they get out of bed, they put on some clothes, they shave, and they say, "Okay, what did Microsoft ship? What patches did it put out?" Because it's an announcement that this is a flaw and we're fixing it. But the good news is most people don't apply the updates right away, if ever. So the hackers now have a brand new territory to get into. That's why it's so important you do install those updates. So not sure why it's hung up. It's not finishing, or is it making progress at all?
It is making progress, but...
Oh, then let it go.
Regardless... It does all the updates. When it pops up, if it says, like, I'm installing one of 68 updates, it goes through them all.
Oh, good.
However, every time, regardless if I get on the computer maybe three or four times throughout the day, every time I get on, it pops up, it's installing.
Well, you may have more updates to install. How long has this been going on for?
Since we restored it.
Which was?
About 2-3 days.
Yeah, it might take that long. So if you go back to the very first version of, is it Windows 7 laptop?
Yes.
You go back to the very first version of Windows 7, it has to do all this catching up involving multiple reboots. So it's normal, as long as it's making progress. As soon as it stops making progress, then maybe you've got a problem. If an update is not installed, if it fails, then it won't go past that, and it'll just keep rebooting. And every time you turn on the machine, it'll say, I'm doing number 67. I can't get 67 to go. That's a different issue. That means you've got a stuck update, and there are ways to remove that update so you can go on. But you really do need to complete those updates, because they're important. And so just keep rebooting and doing it. You might just sit in front of it and keep doing, watch a football game. I hear there's some good ones on, and just or the Golden Globes tonight. And just keep rebooting until it's done.
Okay, perfect. Sounds good.
Yeah, that's normal, and it's very important.
Okay.
And congratulations. Yeah. You fixed the green lines. I don't know. If they come back, then it might be that there's a physical problem with your monitor.
Okay. Well, hopefully they won't. Hopefully they'll stay away.
Yeah, amazing. You fixed it. Good job.
Okay. Well, great. Well, I appreciate your help.
My pleasure, Lauren. Yeah, it's I often am telling people, because they've got spyware or whatever, okay, now you need to reinstall Windows. And, you know, the dirty unspoken phrase is, and it's going to take a while. You install Windows, that's going to take it back to the day it came from the factory, but that was years ago, and now you have months of updates to do. There usually will be, in the case of Windows 7, there's a couple of service packs. You'll do those first. That actually gets a lot of it done. But then there's everything that's happened since the last service pack, and you have to do that, and it takes a while. Reboot, reboot, reboot. Update, update, update. Reboot, reboot, reboot. It may very well take multiple reboots to do this. That's normal. Especially for Windows 7. How old is Windows 7? It's almost 10 years old, right? So that's a lot of updates we got to go through. As many as, you know, were applied to the machine after you bought it. Greg, Palmdale, California. Hi, Greg. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
All right. I'm pretty good, man. Hey, what I got going on is I just completed my home theater,
And been nice. Watching some good stuff.
You yeah. like it? You know that first movie you watch, you sit in the armchair and you listen and the sounds all around you? That feels good, doesn't it?
Oh, it's amazing. The rumbling seats. I got, bass,
big subwoofer. Yeah.
Yeah, I got everything because in the ceiling, 128-inch screen.
Oh, what? Oh, your projector. Yeah. Projector, right?
Yes. Yeah, sir. I got the Epson from your recommendation.
Nice.
The Powerlight 5030 UB cinema system.
Looks good, huh?
All 4K, amazing.
Yeah!
It's awesome.
And man. And what do you watch on that?
Blu-rays so far, but what I'm trying
to stick
get
with the Blu-rays.
I got the nice risers and everything so everybody can
see. Oh, man.
Great theater seats. And
and you did it all yourself?
No, I didn't install it. I built the riser and bought the seats and set that up, but all the tech part, I didn't do that.
Now you got to get a popcorn machine and start selling candy bars in the back.
Already got the popcorn.
Hey, hang on. We have to take a break. I'll help you with your question in just a second. Leo Laporte. Chat room wants to know what your address is, caller, so we can go visit. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. It's Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Talking with Greg in Palmdale. What a nice setup he's got there with the big screen and surround sound. What can I do to help you?
Well, what I want to know is, how the system comes with this tuner, and I have the Blu-ray and my, cable HDMI plugged in there.
Right.
I want to add a device that I can download movies, some of the more current movies on some of those sites. But I want to know what will be the best device to be safe from any kind of viruses or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah, so a home theater PC would do that, obviously, and you could just have it connected up. And there's all sorts of little devices that can do this. Probably the better way to do it, though, would be with something like Plex. Are you familiar with Plex?
No, I'm not. Plex.
So this is software that was originally based on XBMC, the Xbox Media Center. But it's become a whole ecosystem. And the idea of Plex is it is a software that you would run on something that's connected to your TV. Could be a gaming system like a PlayStation. Or could be a Roku. Plex runs on almost everything. A Fire TV. An Apple TV. There's just a huge thing. And then it connects to a media storage, which could be a PC or a network-attached storage. So it's somewhere else. You don't want to have a PC sitting in the living room, trust me, or in the home theater because they're noisy and so forth. So what Plex does is it connects over your network.
So what I have set up, though, is because everything is, instead of IR, I'm RF, I have this great remote.
Nice.
What is it, the MX780?
Yeah, you can go to the bathroom and still change a channel.
Right, exactly. But when I look at it, it has the icons. It has an actual screen on the remote. And it has the cable icon, and it has the icon for the Blu-ray. If I hook up, say, like a Mac or whatever kind of device you're talking about, will that automatically show up on that remote?
Sure. Okay. I mean, it won't automatically. You would have to – you configured the remote in the first place, or the installer configured the remote for the stuff you have. You'd have to add whatever that is.
Okay.
So it could be a PC. It could be a PC in another room that's connected to a Plex device. There are lots of ways to do this. I like the idea of Plex because then you can have something simple hooked up to the home theater system via your AV receiver connected to a larger, giant storage device in a closet somewhere or somewhere on the network. Yeah. That would be a better way to do it, right? You don't want a big old hard drive humming away in the TV in the home theater. It just makes noise.
I was thinking some type of small Mac.
Well, you could do that, absolutely. You can get a Mac Mini. Our Surface Pro 3 would do it. It doesn't have fans. A lot of the more portable devices don't, but they don't. But the problem is how many movies? If you start putting a lot of movies on there, you're going to need extra external storage, and that's going to get noisy. And so
I wasn't really planning to, maybe
just a few movies at a time. No big deal.
Right. Just trying to get
A Mac Mini would be a great choice. $600 has HDMI out, so it plugs right into the AV receiver that you've got there already. I've seen many a home theater system with Max Minis installed. And if you're not going to put a tuner on it, and you're not, you don't need to, that's really pretty simple what you want to do.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the system does have a tuner set up.
Yeah. That's why you don't need to worry about it. So you don't need any special hardware. You just need the Mac Mini as a computer. It'll be on your network. You transfer files over to it, or you can pull it up on the big screen if you want. Have a wireless, Bluetooth keyboard that's connected to the Mac Mini. And then you load your file server or your Netflix or whatever it is that you're getting the media from, play it on the Mac Mini, and it's on the screen.
And then you just need the HDMI cord to run from that Mini to your tuner.
Yep, the modern Mac Minis have HDMI connectors, and of course that makes it very easy. Plus, they're fairly low temperature. You can put them in a cabinet. They're not much different than any other AV component, and they're small.
Well,
yeah, good choice.
Sounds great.
All right, thanks for the call. Boy, I'm jealous. Sounds like a nice home theater. Mike, Eastvale, California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Mike.
Hello, Leo.
How you doing?
Fine, long-time listener. This is my call for help.
That's what I'm here for, baby.
Hey, back in November, I'm on Consumer Cellular, and I upgraded to the Moto G second generation.
Nice choice. That's a very affordable phone that has most of the features of the high-end phones. It's a good choice, I think.
Okay, the problem is it auto-updates, and when it does it over mobile data.
Yeah.
Every day at 6 a.m.
What's it doing?
And it does this on its own. I call Consumer Cellular. They can't figure it out. I called Motorola, spent an hour with six different people.
There's not, you know, the updates aren't that frequent. I don't know what it's updating. Are you seeing it on your bill? I mean, are you seeing a big bandwidth consumption?
Well, I pay for 100 megabytes because I'm usually at home.
Yeah, you don't want that. Yeah, you want to use Wi-Fi.
Yes, and so the first month, I went up to 87, so it gave me warning, you know.
Right.
So, but this month, I'm only up to 30 with about 15 days in, but there's no way to turn it off at the auto at the three times during the day.
Well, here's my guess, and I'm surprised Consumer hasn't told you this. Now, I have a Moto X, which is just like the G. It's just a higher-end version of the G, and it doesn't update three times a day. That is almost certainly Consumer doing that. And it's probably updating a very tiny file, which is probably the file for your internet settings on that phone, something like that. Or it's checking the baseband radio or something like that. Something specific to your cell carrier, because it's not normal. So what I think it's Consumer. I'm surprised Consumer didn't say that. The good news is probably it's not the phone. It's Consumer's updating something, and the good news is probably very small.
Yeah, so, it's one or two at a time, but the first month it was updating the whole phone, so it
that's
got
bizarre.
The end.
I don't. Yeah, you should get an entire phone update, which is hundreds of megabytes. That should only happen every few months. And by the way, in the settings, you can make sure that that only happens over Wi-Fi.
That's what I have it.
Yeah.
I have it.
But that's why I'm saying this is Consumer. This is something that the phone company is doing over its cellular network. And frankly, they should not charge you for that because they're requiring it.
Yeah, they told me if I do go over 100, they'll pay for it.
Yeah. It's not updating apps, right? It's on a schedule. 6 a.m., I got an update.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's got to be your phone company.
And it updates even if my phone is off. Figure that?
That's weird. That's your phone company. They're doing something. They may, as part of the deal, I'm not familiar with Consumer. They may, as part of the deal, be updating some small file on a regular basis. How do you know it's updating? It puts up a message?
No. I can go and look at my account and download, you know, activity. And every day, 6, 12, and 6. Huh. And, you know, I like them because I'm retired. For $35 a month, we get two phones. It's great, but when you know you're reaching the limit and you have to pay.
Well, is it getting? See, you have it set not to use cellular data, right? For email, all of that stuff. That's in the settings, and you've got it set Wi-Fi only.
Yes.
Well, you know, one thing you could do just to see what happens is turn off cellular data and see if it still updates. But if
Consumer told me to turn off mobile data.
Yeah.
But when I do that, you can't send pictures.
Yeah, you get no mobile data. But just try that for a day just to see.
Oh, yeah, I did. On my wife's phone, I turned it off, and there was no updates coming.
I think it's Consumer, but I can't be sure. The other thing you could do is make sure you go in the Play Store and turn on that Wi-Fi only in the Play Store because it may be updating apps. That does not normally happen on a schedule. That happens when there's an update. But I would
that's
go.
That's what Motorola told me to do, and I did that.
Yeah. So you have Wi-Fi only for updates.
Yes.
All I can think of, the only thing I can think of, is the consumer is doing some, pushing some few bytes down on a regular schedule to make sure that you've got the correct settings for its internet access or whatever. It's consumer. It's got to be, and they should know what that is, and that should be, because it's forcing it through cellular, which usually means it's the cell company pushing it. They don't want to push it. They can't push it via Wi-Fi. They have to push it through the network. So
that's probably why they told me they'd paid for it.
Yeah, they know. They know whatever's going on. They must know. So I would say blame consumer and say, I'm not paying for this. It's you. I've turned off everything but, you know, that does it any other way. Hey, thanks for joining us. Have a great Geek Week. Thank you, Heather Hammond. Take care. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.